Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin, and I'm in conversation today with Alex Zablosky, who is the Managing Director for PJ Library. And when I think about all of the wonderful things that are happening in the Jewish communal space, and as I was relaunching this program, it was a no-brainer for me to think about PJ Library. And while Alex is part of a much larger organization and is not at the head of that organization, he definitely runs a really wonderful, vital part of our Jewish communal landscape. And I'm so excited to hear from him about his experience in leading these efforts. So welcome, Alex.
Great. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. So we'll start, as we always do, with just your own personal journey and how you found yourself in this role.
Yeah, by accident, honestly. So my wife and I, at that point, weren't married yet. We were living in Boston, and we decided to move back to West Hartford, Connecticut, which is where I grew up, closer to her parents who were in Western Massachusetts. And I was networking to try and find a job here and end up getting connected with Harold Grinspoon. And we had dinner, and I answered enough questions, right, that he invited me to the office the next day to meet the professional team at the Harold Grinspoon Foundation. And there was a job opening for an operations coordinator. The PJ Library program at that point was looking to expand to the UK, to Russia, and to start offering programs for 9 to 12-year-olds. And they were looking for someone to help figure out how to mail chapter books instead of picture books and postal service in the UK. So I had a chance to join the team in that role. And then over the last 9+ years, just grow with the program as it's really expanded in every direction. Really most of that time as director of operations and building out the operational side of the program, and the last few years getting to work kind of across the entire program globally.
And so what were you doing before Harold snatched you up and, and brought you into the fold?
Yeah. So that was also kind of an accidental thing. I was working at the Cohen Center for Modern Jewish Studies at Brandeis University. So helping with the birthright research, working on a project called JData, some other social science research on the Jewish community. I did my undergrad at Brandeis, and after I got my MBA at Bar Ilan in Israel, when I got back to the States, again, networks took me back to Brandeis. So I was working there for a few years.
Excellent. May we all be so lucky that a simple conversation leads to, you know, a fulfilling career. That sounds that sounds wonderful. So for those that live under a rock and don't know what PJ Library is, or maybe don't have kids, but still, I don't know how you don't know what it is, but please just walk us through the sort of general concept of what the program is.
Yeah, and I would say there are so many people who haven't heard about PJ Library, so happy to have the chance to talk about it. So PJ Library has been around for almost 18 years at this point, and what we try and do is encourage parents to have conversations with their kids and pass on what's most meaningful to them about Jewish life. And we do that for the starting point of the gift of a monthly Jewish storybook that shows up in the mailbox every month. So every month, at no cost to the family, the kid gets a picture book with Jewish themes or values or holidays or traditions. And hopefully that's a spark for the family to have a conversation and maybe explore what they want to, you know, what their connection is going to be to Jewish life.
So now, were you around because, you know, what you failed to mention is it's not really just books, right? So we've gotten aprons and Sadaka boxes and puzzles and games and all sorts of fun, engaging stuff. Was there a point in which that shifted? Because I think it used to just be, you know, books, and, you know, suddenly all these other wonderful things started showing up. Were you around when that shift happened?
Yes. That was part of the kind of the really steep growth trajectory that I've gotten to play a role in. Which was fun. So since the beginning, it was books and it was CDs originally. Music is
CDs, yes.
at some point, kind of phased out as a technology,
right?
But picture books have been there since the beginning. And then, while I've been part of the team, where we've introduced middle grade books for older kids, right? So the content is still a very Jewish theme, but the format changes, right? It's more graphic novels. It's middle grade chapter books and that sort of thing. And then, yeah, we think about what within the constraints of the United States Postal Service and Canada Post we can deliver through the mail to help, again, encourage those conversations and those meaningful Jewish moments in the household. So a tzedakah box, which we now send to all subscribers when they turn 3, We sent an apron and a mitzvah pack backpack with an accompanying music video. So just things that, again, can encourage conversations in the home. And then within the book, sometimes we've tested out and we've included, at this point, and we counted recently, it was like 14 or 15 extra items. So something to help families explore the, you know, blessing the children on Friday night, which, and the way we took it was, it's not just to deliver the text, but what kind of object, what interesting interactive thing we deliver. And we still use it in my house where it's a never ender.
It's like a fidget, right? Yeah, no, I've got fidget, that too. Exactly. Yeah. So like
my kids, they will not sit still, but for those 30 seconds on Friday night, if they're holding the fidget, the never ender, they'll do it. And we hear from families that they're still using it many years later. And so that's the kind of thing that we're looking to do, to make kind of make the old new and have something that's quick but deep and something that's beautiful and interactive and engaging. So those are the extra things we kind of sneak into the envelope.
Yeah, I love it. And this year you guys did like a Hanukkah, not a murder mystery, but an appropriate mystery. Yes. for tiny, a missing, something's missing mystery. That was just really wonderful. And I actually have a 3 and a 5-year-old. And so I got kind of two ends of the spectrum of what you guys created in terms of, you know, the big puzzle that was 4 pieces and then the, you know, larger puzzle that was, you know, a lot of pieces. And it was very creative in terms of the things you guys are able to, like you said, put through the mail, which is great. So I'd love to hear, you know, from your understanding, the sort of creation of this project. And so, you know, I've, you know, heard a little bit about Harold Greenspoon and his story, and obviously this is about you and your story. But hearing a little bit about, you know, what was missing, what was the impetus for saying we should send kids free Jewish books? I mean, that's, you know, a very interesting idea, right?
Yeah. It really started, you know, as Harold looking in the world and both perceiving the need and also kind of synthesizing in his head kind of other things he was interacting with. So at the same time, he was sponsoring the Imagination Library program in Western Massachusetts, which is Dolly Parton's literacy program, which is run through the Dollywood Foundation. So which they send essentially books through the mail for, you know, so for children to build their own libraries. It started in Eastern Tennessee and it's expanded now globally. And at the same time, he was a Passover Seder at his daughter-in-law, Winnie Sandler Grinspoon's home. And as the Afikoman gift, she gave the kids, her kids, his grandkids at the Seder books. And he saw how excited they were and they climbed on people's laps and they got read to. And together he said, wait, why don't we kind of meld these two ideas and address what he was, in his mind was the challenge, was that there was a, right, the sense of making sure that parents and grandparents could pass on to their kids meaningful Jewish life and joyful Jewish life. So he said, let's try it. So he, through the foundation, we reached out to a couple hundred families in Western Massachusetts and asked if they'd be interested in getting a Jewish book in the month, every month. And they said yes. And very quickly it scaled and expanded. And, at this point we estimate we're reaching 30% of Jewish kids in the US and Canada.
You can hear me. Yes. My technology is still a little bit finicky.
Good.
People have listened to previous ones, but that's okay. That's awesome. So it's interesting that you talk about grandparents, because as a synagogue executive director, and I don't really hear this so often, but, you know, sometimes we get the, well, my mom really wanted us to, you know, belong to a synagogue and, you know, they're the ones paying for religious school and we kind of just go along with it. And so, you know, there's not that PJ Library is replacing synagogue engagement, but when you talk about people wanting to pass on, you know, Judaism and culture and things like that, that maybe for their interfaith, you know, child or their child that's just like not really that into Judaism in terms of practicing, you know, this is obviously a really great way for people to pass down those traditions, and even more so with a game about Israel, which I just like will keep praising the work that you guys do, because I just love it so much. But so for you, in terms of the sort of back end of this project, you know, you came in one sort of operational, you know, place, and now you've sort of taken on more of a leadership role. Were there expectations that you had either being in this role or even coming into the organization at all that were very different than reality, or specific ways that, you know, things have changed that you weren't necessarily expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what you touched on earlier, in the sense that when I started working here, I assumed it was a program for kids. And I quickly learned that it's actually, or the content is geared for children. Kids are a core part of it, but it's actually a program for parents. That's really our target audience, in terms of giving them the tools and the resources to be able to be the lead Jewish educator of their child, certainly in their home. And that's really, we touched on interfaith as well. And speaking from my own experience, my wife is converted to Judaism, wasn't raised Jewish. So my in-laws aren't Jewish, but they're very supportive of we're raising Jewish children. They want to be part of it, but it's hard for them to find an avenue in, but they can read a children's book.
Right. Interesting. Right? Yeah.
And my wife, who didn't have Jewish education growing up, can read a children's book and learn at the same time as them if she wants to, if it's something that's new to them, or even someone who was raised Jewish and may not know about a particular holiday or custom. A children's book is that's a kind of a universal skill in terms of reading to a child. And we include on the flaps, the inside cover of the books, content for the grown-up, right? So whoever's reading the book to the kid can have some help in terms of talking about the content, the definitions of what's going on, some ideas for activities. Because really that was the thing that I learned very quickly is that actually it's for the grown-ups to help them in their conversations with kids. And grandparents in particular, they get PJ Library much quicker than parents do. They just organically, immediately understand, okay, this is going to help convey what's important to them to generations down. So really it's a multi-generational experience oftentimes.
That's interesting. I would have never thought of that. It was actually what you were saying made me think about even just so my husband has a podcast called Torah Smash, and they talk about the intersection between nerd culture and Judaism, basically that like you could take any nerd something and something in there is Jewish, right? So it makes me think of you guys had a book called that was just the song It's a Wonderful World.
Right.
And here is this secular song that like is not Jewish, kind of made into like, look how you could take this secular song and it's, see Jewish components in it. And I feel like in terms of, an apron, right? Could use it for anything, right? You don't have to be making
lock. I lost audio for a second.
Yeah, I got to get that fixed, huh? I'm back. So I was saying that, there's stuff that you put out that you still can't hear me. Oh, no. Can you hear me now? Really?
Let's go to my webcam. Can you hear me now? You can't hear me at all. Oh, no.
All right. So we're back. Had a bit of a technical difficulty, but I think we're back here. So what I was saying was that you guys published a book on with just a secular your song, It's a Wonderful World. And, you provided an apron, right? There are some things, a game, right? Things that aren't inherently Jewish, right? You're not necessarily mailing a menorah or, tzedakah box, yes, but, candles, right? These things in terms of pushing Jewish traditions and things on people to do that, sometimes it's just about, hey, there's Judaism everywhere, right? We're talking about the birthday of the world and this isn't a Jewish book. It's just talking about, themes in the world that are Jewish. So it's very interesting for me to hear from you that, the target audience in terms of, people you want to adopt your program, kid isn't going to go sign up for PJ Library, right? The parent and the adult is. And even if a kid gets a game in the mail, they're not going to just, play it unless there's an adult who's like sitting there ready and willing to play it with them, which is so great. And that's a very interesting change in expectation.
Yeah. And I would say that the core experience also, right? Like the assumption is like, in this country, at least, most of our audience are reading to their kids anyway, right? So instead of what we're suggesting is you swap out the book you're reading with the Jewish book, right? So we're kind of, again, it's a behavior that's already happening in the home and just swapping out that moment of a could be a bedtime story. It could be a story anytime. And, knowing as a parent myself, books get read all sorts of places,
right?
Having that be a Jewish moment. And it's probably not how Harold would ever describe it, but at its core, it's that we're introducing the concept of a chavruta, right, of learning in a pair. Right? We're giving a Jewish text and having a parent and a child in conversation about it. So it's really, it's not, it's actually a very old concept, right? And it's taking, again, this moment that's happening anyway and allowing it to be a Jewish moment.
That's awesome. Yeah. So talking about the challenges, I mean, I can only assume, you're sending out free books every month. You have a wide range of ages you're doing it for. You're sending out activities. You guys have podcasts, which I've already talked to you about how much I love.
Yeah.
And, I know you partner really closely with federations. you know, what are the challenges that you guys face? I mean, you obviously all have, you know, there's salaries, there's PR, there's, you know, writers, there's printing costs, there's mailing costs. I mean, I can only assume, you know, how large your actual operating budget is. And maybe that's not a challenge. I'm not sure. So I'm just curious, you know, what are the challenges that you face as you, you know, try to push and promote and expand the reach of this program?
Yeah. I would say that, certainly, as you said, like it's gotten quite the big ecosystem. Our operating budget just to the foundation this year for PG Library is $36.5 million. Mm. That covers our global program. At this point, we're mailing books in more than 35 countries in 7 languages.
Wow.
Right. And again, in the US and Canada, reaching 30% of Jewish kids every month. So just the amount of moving parts is tremendous. And we've got a great team all around the world making that happen. And we've got, as you said, really great partners locally. So we have a lead partner in 180 plus communities in the US and Canada. So usually a federation or a JCC, sometimes a synagogue or a family service or another agency. And then they partner further to make sure that PG Library's the materials and the brand is available to all organizations. I think the challenge is at this point, certainly the last few years with all the supply chain issues. Mm. I mean, reminded we live in the real world, right? So when things slow down, our books are slowed down on those boats also. When the tanker got the ship got stuck in the Suez Canal, we felt that in terms of the delays. So like that was, it was like a supply chain and postal rate challenges. But the real challenge is honestly finding new families to enroll and continuing to grow. Right. You know, we enroll, approaching 50,000 new kids every year. But at this point, obviously we've scaled that really is just replacing those kids who are turning 9 and aging out of the 0-8 program. So as we're looking to really grow and reach more families, finding them, right? Especially families who aren't at the moment connected to Jewish life, is a challenge. And that's a classic kind of marketing advertising challenge and how much we're going to spend and where, and we're constantly trialing because we know we have something that works and it's impactful. And we know that the families who have yet to enroll are the ones who are most likely to be positively impacted. So that's why we're looking to really keep expanding our reach.
Yeah. What do you think would lead somebody to like learn about your program and be like, nah, I'm good? Like, I'm just like, it is so like, who says no to free books coming in the door, especially if they are Jewish identifying in some way? 30% just seems so low in terms of something that I feel like is a no brainer for people to want to adopt. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but you're like, I know, right? I'm curious if there's been feedback that, people who have either signed up and said, no, I'm good, or people who hear about it and are like, not for me, who have yet, because free books for young kids. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you're welcome to join our marketing team. It's our number, right? That's what we're asking ourselves all the time. And even 30%, I mean, we're really proud of the 30%. It's 240,000 books going out in the US and Canada every month. So it's a big number. Mm-hmm. But that means, right, there's 70% of kids eligible who aren't signed up yet. So there's still a lot of work to be done. We're actually engaging in some more traditional market research right now, over in this kind of this fall, asking that exact question. That's like the one question I really want the answer to. But anecdotally, what we've heard both from our local partners and directly from families, it ranges. Sometimes people just don't trust things that are free. Sometimes people, and really the most painful thing we hear is that people think they're not Jewish enough. And we tell them, all you have to do is you're just getting free books. You don't have to.
Right.
But they feel like in some ways they picked up the sense that they're not Jewish enough. They don't do enough. It's not for them. Mm. And so we found actually the most successful is relationship-based marketing, where it starts with a conversation with a friend, with a local professional, with a parent connector that one of the federations or JCCs has hired, and have a relationship first, right? Get to know each other first, and then offer, then they feel open to signing up for the program. But everyone has their own story. And it's ever since, for the 9+ years that I've been here, 40% of our new enrollments come from word of mouth, from friends and family. That's always the number one.
Right. Well, there's your new tagline. Don't feel Jewish enough? Sign up for PG Library. There you go. That's a very interesting sort of feedback to have received, because that really is sort of the crux of the Jewish community in general that we deal with. I'm actually reading Dr. Erica Brown's book on Jewish leadership, and right now is specifically the section on, the you know, constituents that we're working with. And, you know, there is that factor of, you know, people who were raised Jewish, but like I said, maybe their partner is or isn't Jewish, and they're just not sure about how they're going to, you know, raise their kids, or they don't make time for Shabbat anymore. They don't make time for, you know, the Jewish holidays, but that doesn't mean that they aren't themselves Jewish, or that a book about the world and being, you know, a good person in the world around Rosh Hashanah time. And I think that's, you know, what a lot of newer Jewish nonprofit organizations are trying to do right now is, you know, did you love going to Jewish summer camp as a kid? Like, come as an adult, like to our retreat right. again. Like, you loved having Shabbat. We'll pay for you to have Shabbat with your friends, you know, around the table, or, you know, find ways to connect that are sort of super low bar, that aren't the traditional synagogue membership and coming to services that doesn't connect with everybody the same way. And that's an interesting shift in general that, in our Jewish communal landscape, for better or worse, as someone who sits as the executive director of a synagogue, but yeah. a growing in. Synagogue involvement, you can hear me, okay, good. or engagement for those for whom it's meaningful, but, you know, knowing that there are now just such a plethora of ways to be Jewish. And right. You know, I've been really thinking about sort of blue ocean strategy in terms of, you know, the Jewish community now feels so saturated with these sort of newer emerging ways to be Jewish, ways to plug in, you know, what could possibly be missing. And so it's interesting to hear about Harold's experience in which, you know, stop looking internally to say, well, what's missing from all the stuff that we have, but looking externally and saying, what does the regular world have that... Yeah. that we don't have that might be beneficial in ways that people, you know, connect to their Judaism. And this was awesome.
On that point, I think it's a really good one. It's something that we've been testing out, and we're working on scaling now, is what we call our Get Together program, where it's actually looking to parents themselves to design what they want to do. So with, you know, it's a micro incentive program for $100, which seems to offer it to families, invite two other families and do something Jewish yourself, right? Host a Shabbat meal, do something.
I love that.
Shabbat, build a sukkah. And oftentimes they invite and welcome and are grateful for the support from a local professional, from someone at a synagogue or a JCC mm-hmm. or a federation to help them design how to do it. Cause people really want to do it the right way. And from the PG Library perspective, there's no right way and wrong way, right? It's whatever is right for that family. And we try not to be prescriptive in that regard and just give a menu of ideas and inspiration and opportunities. But, more and more we found that parents themselves want to have a hand in designing it. For That's many, awesome. You know, synagogue is right. Other JCCs are right. And we love that. That's great. We want to mm-hmm. make sure that they always know what's in their community and are encouraged to try that out. But for a lot of families, kind of this DIY, this muscle that they built during COVID, especially, is proving to be really, really interesting.
That's awesome, because that takes money out of your budget by saying, oh, you want to volunteer, do it yourself, go for it. I mean, that's always the sort of push and pull we deal with in synagogue yeah. life, right? Is, you know, you pay professionals well, hopefully, you know, to do stuff. But at the same time, like, the volunteers don't want you to do too much stuff, because then it's not, you know, their community, yeah. it's you doing stuff for them. And so finding that balance of, you know, well, you can do for yourself and let us help support that. And, you know, and also, you know, we're going to also support you on this side by giving you really great materials and professionals to work with so that you can make that happen and build those communities on a more micro scale.
Totally. Because, I mean, we hear it consistently, and I think the other research too, not just PG Library research, where, you know, in our 75%, you know, huge percentages of families in our context, but individuals are looking for community. It's not that the demand isn't there.
Yeah. Oh, at least in our area, the demand is there. And as we grow, I mean, the challenge is just how do you meet the expectations that they came to you with, sure. right? And so I'm sure you manage that on your own scale in terms yeah. of, you know, they're coming to you wanting this connection possibly, and, you know, make sure to deliver on that. And how do you do that when they're going to some stranger's home and you have no, you know, control over the, you know, the experience that person's going to have in someone else's home, but you can offer the, you know, financial support, you can offer the professional support, and just hope that they, that it's a good experience for them and they connect with others, which is great.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about the future, what the vision is. I mean, I mentioned already the two podcasts you guys have, right?
Yep, at the moment too.
And I'm going to put you on the spot. Is there going to be another season of Beyond the Bookcase? Because I have to tell my kid whether or not there's going to be a new episode.
Yes, dropping this fall. We're going to have
awesome.
Yep, Beyond the Bookcase and Afternoons with Mimi. And we're also going to be choosing a Russian and a Ukrainian storytelling podcast as well. So we're expanding a little bit.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I was talking with Rabbi Farkas, who's the CEO mm-hmm. out in Los Angeles, and he was mentioning, man, they just have a huge Russian population, and how are they serving that population? So it's very interesting to hear from you guys that it's not just about, you know, the white Ashkenazi, you know, Jewish population that you serve anyway, but you know, that there's so many other diverse, I mean, and Israeli as well, right? Israeli that live in the States or in Canada mm-hmm. in terms of you know, that population and keeping them engaged with Jewish life in a different setting than the one they experienced in Israel. So vision. I know I derailed us with the podcast and my child's love of it.
But, no, it's a great jumping off point, actually, because we talked about growth already and continuing to expand our reach and just engage more families. But really looking at the content that we're curating and we're doing a lot of investments right now, the podcast, both in terms of new formats and delivering stories in different formats to families. And digital is really powerful. We can deliver more stories mm-hmm. in a much quicker turnaround time than we can in book format, right? You can take an idea to a podcast episode in a matter of months, as opposed to you have an idea for a book. You're not going to hold that book for 2 or 3 years, right? So digital and continue to figure out what our digital, how that complements our monthly book lineup. Again, it also allows us to reach families in different languages and different parts of all parts of the world at the same time. There's a lot of advantages there, but we're also doing a lot of investments in storytellers and the stories they're telling. Mm-hmm. What actually the lineup is going to be, and we've distributed many, many books, but we're looking for new stories, stories told different ways by new storytellers, and we're working right now. We've taken several cohorts of authors to Israel.
Oh, awesome!
To engage them in work that we're doing, encourage them to write. So we're actually taking two cohorts over the next 12 months, one of illustrators and visual storytellers, really focusing on not just the words, but also the art in the book, which is just as powerful for a kid. And then our next cohort will be focusing on Sephardic and Mizrahi storytellers and really focusing in to make sure that those stories are also being told and represented in the lineup. And I think that's the direction we're going, making sure that we're looking, you know, we have a content framework in terms of our aspirational lineup is going to be. And we're looking at that and saying, hey, where are the places where it's a little thinner or we need a little bit more for a certain age group, and really being more intentional about encouraging and expanding, both deepening, broadening and diversifying the pool of content creators who are telling the story so that we have what to curate for our lineup.
That's really awesome. I love that. So bringing it back to you, so again, you kind of found yourself in a position, a $36 million budget is not nothing. And, you know, most times in nonprofits, you know, the staff cost is a majority of a budget just because of, you know, the physical program, whereas you're actually physically producing a thing, which I'm assuming is, you know, part of that budget. But, you know, how do you try to show up as a leader for your staff, as a partner for your partners, as, you know, as somebody who's employing these, I guess employing might not be the right word, but who is, you know, contracting with these authors, giving them an experience, helping to expand them creatively. I mean, you wear a lot of different hats in terms of
one part.
Yeah. in terms of the way that you show up in your work. So I'd love to hear about maybe, you know, ways that you have changed in the way that you've shown up or all that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's been interesting shifting from a very operational, so really solely focused on operational kind of perspective to the broader perspective. And as you said, I mean, it's, you know, with a budget this large, with an ecosystem that we're working in with so many different elements, I mean, that's what I really like about the position and this work is that we get to toggle between very creative conversations with authors and publishers to the budgeting to partnerships. You know, it runs the gamut. So what I try and do in showing up as a leader is to just give the team context. We've got a great team. It's a big team, and they at this point are spread out all around the world. So making sure people have the information they need so that they can make the best decisions and do their work, because there's just great, talented, creative people on the team that I want to make sure that they're in a position to do their best work.
So you have remote workers, is that, I assume most of them are probably remote, right?
Yeah. I mean, so we started out back in the day, the foundation was, everyone was in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is where for Herald businesses. And then it was already starting, we had more and more remote employees pre-pandemic. And then the last few years, we've been looking for the best people regardless of location. So at this point, probably a third of our team is fully remote. You know, we've got offices at this point in Ramat Gan in Israel, in London, in Moscow, in Kiev, in São Paulo. It's, wow. And then employees, all over US and Canada. So it's a broad spread out team. And that's part of the challenge is how you make sure people feel connected in this, we're not alone in this, right? In these boxes, right? And how in the context of, in how the Health Foundation, but as the PG Library program, how everyone has the context and knows what everyone else is doing in that virtual ecosystem so we can all move forward.
So how do you do that? I mean, I feel like there's a lot of research that's coming out now about, work from home. I think I just read one that was like the carbon bubble that if you're in your basement alone for too long, I mean, talk about offices too, but
yeah.
I mean, my husband works from home and well, it is phenomenal in terms of our work-life balance, in terms of him popping in a load of laundry or, getting the mail, whatever it happens to be in terms of, the things that you can't do, all day in an office. There's Zoso alone all day and he's in the same place all day. And I happen to be, in an office where I regularly interacting with people and I enjoy that. So I'm curious if there is any kind of intentional strategy behind, you talk about paying people to get together, right? Saying here's $20 to go to a coffee shop instead of being in your house or, I don't know if you pay for, offices for people who have they either don't have the space to have a home office or it's more challenging for them to be home all the time. I'm curious how you navigate that.
I would say it's emerging right now because, I think, we had a, 2 or 3 years where we weren't really working remotely. We were kind of at home during a pandemic trying to get work done, which I think is a different right. thing than actually designing intentionally what it's like to work remotely or hybrid. There's no replacement for being in person with people in the same room and having the space, right? The luxury of time with someone for the side conversations, the extra. I think that's the most limiting part about being on Zoom is it's a very transactional. Okay, we're going to have our conversation that was scheduled, and then we're going to hang up, and it's hard to have that relationship building time. So, and again, with 2/3 of our staff still based in the office, there is still a lot of that. And what our challenge here is more for those people having that experience where, okay, we're 3 days a week in the office, 2 days a week remote here, but who people who are 100% remote, how do we have them feel like they're connected in?
And that arrangement too is kind of challenging, right? I couldn't imagine having my whole setup in my office where I'm most productive, then also at home and trying to toggle between the two. I'm sure it also presents challenges.
Yeah. So I think from our perspective, I think we're really trying to build in-person touch points also. So encouraging people to come to the home office for visits. We have an all staff retreat once a year.
That's great.
Looking to, really I'm informed a lot by, pre-pandemic, I was supervising our international teams. So we were on Zoom primarily anyway, but it's important that at least once a year you go visit them, they come visit you, you spend time. You have to have that as well. It can't only be virtual. That's really hard.
Right. Yeah. So coming back to you once more, I'd love to hear about, your own life as much as you'd like to share. I mean, just trying to schedule, this is challenging, right? In terms of finding an hour for a podcast and, today's so busy for me, but I was like, nope, I'm getting Alex.
Well, thank you for that.
A lot of other execs that, also have that, that challenge and, mindfulness practices or waking up at 5 a.m. or just finding ways to manage the demands of the position and also, home life and self-care and all those ways that all those things we should be doing versus the ways that we actually live our life. So I'm curious from your perspective, how you keep that all sort of balanced and together and make sure to make time for the things that that make your life, happy and enjoyable.
Yeah. I would say the number one thing for me is Shabbat. I don't, right, this is a sliding scale. I wouldn't necessarily call it Shomer Shabbat in terms of keeping Shabbat to, the full extent, but I don't work on Shabbat and everyone at and the team knows, and like it's a hard pass, like, you know, it's a hard line, like when that time comes Friday afternoon, no matter where I am, that's it, I'm done for the week. And just having that kind of hard break and separation between work and then Shabbat when I'm not working, I think it's really valuable, because otherwise the work just becomes all consuming. It's because, again, having right team members all around the world, there's always emails coming in, there's something's happening somewhere always, and it's hard to step out of that. So having that moment, you're like, nope, every week, once a week, that's going to stop for a while. Mm-hmm. I think it's the most valuable. And I appreciate also that working at the foundation at the PG Library, there's the flexibility that I can, right, go home and have dinner with my kids every day. I'll log back on in the evening, right, in that sense of it never really right. stopped. But there's enough flexibility in it that there are certain things that I've named, these are important also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that between, you know, the differences with, you know, somebody who works for a national organization and somebody who works for, you know, a local organization, in terms of, you know, from the national perspective, they're like, well, you know, I might be gone at a conference or a thing for a couple of days, but when I'm home, I can be home and I'm home for dinner. Whereas those right. like myself or JCCs or more right. local organizations are like, I got meetings every night or right. often nights. And sometimes I'm not, like, I mean, today is my long day. I, you know, left before my kids were awake and I will not be there when they go to bed. And that's, you know, that's okay, right? Not that that doesn't happen when you have to travel, but it's, you know, interesting dichotomy of experience when you take on a role like this to think about, you know, what part is more important, right? So I have a conference for executive directors in the fall and I'm like, do I really want to be gone for, yeah. you know, for a week when I'm, you know, have all these evening things, high holidays, you know, all that stuff is my regular course. You kind of have to make that balance. And so it's interesting when you sort of explore those dichotomies of the type of position that you take on, how to kind of make that balance. So that's
totally, and it's not easy. Like, it's much easier said than done, right? Like, in terms of, but I think that's part of the leadership also, if you're setting an example that, like, no, there are gonna be moments where I'm gonna put this down and do something else and I'll be back mm-hmm. on in 5 minutes. Like, but right now I'm gonna take a little bit of a break, right? I think that's also an important example to set, because it's such good work and because everyone cares so much about it and it's so fulfilling in many ways. Like, it's, you can, but it never stops, right? It can be all consuming and you have to set some boundaries for yourself, and it's much easier said than done.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking with the CEO of the Jewish Funders Network, and he was saying that there was a time that he's like, oh, I have to go manage an emergency. And his friend was like, you work for a foundation. Like, what possibly is the emergency totally. That you have to do right now?
Totally. Like, that's the first thing I tell people when they start. That way. The team. I'm like, the word emergency has a very specific connotation. We don't use it here.
Right.
We have a few important, impactful, time-sensitive work. We don't have emergencies. Like, that's a very specific right. thing. Don't use that word here. That's
good.
The book is late. The book is late, and it's a real bummer. And we should reflect on why that happened and not have it happen again. But it's not an emergency.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a hard shift to internalize. I mean, we here at the synagogue, we have high holidays. For the first time, we were going to do it offsite at a middle school. Mm-hmm. And what, it's, you know, the end of August and high holidays is in 15 some odd days. And we get a call from the middle school that says, I'm sorry, we have to be in a construction and we can't have you for high holidays, right? So immediately you're like, panic, crisis, emergency, we have to find it. And I was like, everyone just calm down. Hey. Let's meet at this time. Let's talk about it. It'll be fine. And that's not always easy when... Yeah. You're presented with something like, there's a ship stuck in the Suez Canal and we can't get our product right. out. I mean, that feels very emergency, but keeping that sort of calm in those situations to say, yes, this is a crisis. We will take care of it. I am taking my kid to summer camp or to college, or, you know, I'm on a cruise myself, like that, or half of our staff are, right? So this weekend we have three of our important leaders taking their kids to college. So it's like, everyone just take a deep breath. Well, you know, but that's, you know, not always easy to do when you live, you know, your work and it feels that important and that urgent when something needs to be taken care of.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. So my presumed audience are Jewish professionals out there working in a variety of different organizations and your own, you know, staff members that get to work with you that are listening. What's some advice that you might have for Jewish professionals at all stages of their work life that you feel would be important to partake in that for them?
No, we kind of talked about it already. I was going to use the Shabbat one as my
Shabbat is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't have to be Shabbat, but like having that, like really like setting the checking those priorities and having something that's not but you're not going to compromise on that one. That's not flexible, right? And that's why I think the power of Shabbat is, like, that's when it is. You can't move it. You can't reschedule it. You can't, right? That's really,
yeah. Unlike an exercise routine, where you're like, well, I normally go on Tuesdays, but right, now it's a Tuesday. Exactly. It's only on Thursday. Yeah, that's, right.
Right, exactly. So right.
That's not, like, moving. It's always the same. Right. Yeah.
I think that's the powerful thing, because otherwise, you know, you're tempted to move it. I think that's the. And then the second one, I think, is really what we talked about already, in terms of just having that perspective of saying, right, and sometimes in life there are emergencies, but not everything is. I think that those are the two that I think really I try and hold. And that's really the energy I try and bring to, you know, this work in this office and my leadership, but, like, just try and stay to be the calming kind of, you know, calm things down presence, and not the, you know, things are kind of sped up and, enough already. They don't need me to add fuel to that fire.
Right. Everything will get done. That's the, you know, it doesn't have to all get done.
And
right
then
now.
And Shabbat will come, and some things won't be done, and it'll be there for you after Shabbat. It's not going anywhere, right? The pile is not gonna go anywhere.
Right. That's great. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we've covered a bunch of ground, both with the work that PJ Library does and the sort of variety of work that it does, and its vision for the future of engagement and connection, and just promoting the joys of Jewish life to anyone who, you know, is looking to get that through, you know, children books and children activities and connections through our children. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention or talk about in our conversation about your work or your journey?
No, I think we covered that. That's options out there. If you have a friend or a family member who hasn't yet signed up, might be interested, encourage them to check it out. I think it's, I'm really proud of what our team is putting out into the world and what all of our partners are doing locally. We didn't really talk much about the local engagement work and the community building work that's so critical. And that's really, like, the ultimate goal, honestly, is to have families feel part of community, whatever community means to them. So our local partnerships around the world are critical for that. We can't hold community as a foundation based in Agawam, Massachusetts, right? Like, we can deliver content, we can support and coach and train and fund, but that's where really the magic happens, on the ground, when relationships are built in community. So that's, there's a lot there. So if you know somebody who might be right for them,
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, so awesome when I think about it in terms of, you know, PJ Library could have just been books, right? Could have just been the thing it was created to do. Yeah. And instead, you and your leadership before you and, you know, your staff have said, you know, and even the reach, right? It could have just been like, we do books. How do we get books into more people's hands? Right. You know, you've taken the active step to say that's not enough for what we're trying to accomplish here. It's, as I said before, it's merchandising, it's games, it's activities, it's podcasts. It's, you know, how do we get people together? Yeah. And in a world where, you know, sometimes Judaism feels inaccessible when all you see are synagogues, or that's all you know. You know, I'm sure for these 30% of Jewish kids that are plugged into this, and I know it's really made an impact on our lives and our kids' lives, and, you know, getting that envelope every month, because it's not like any other kind of subscription where you know it's coming, you've ordered a thing, right? You made your order on Amazon and then it's it's just, you just get the mail, you're like, oh, PJ Library books are here. And you go to open it and you just don't know what you're gonna get, right? It's not like you've got an email that says this is what you expect in your inbox, or that you've ordered something. Like, it's just such a joyful part of Judaism for our family, and I'm sure such a joyful part of Judaism for the people you've engaged. So best of luck in expanding and in addition to people who want to sign up, if you're a donor or know a donor, I'll do that plug for you. Foundation. That, you know, I know that's, you know, a big part of how
it,
you operate.
We tell people it costs a lot to be this free. Right. So we never charge families, but you still have to buy and ship and do all the stuff.
To raise $36 million.
So absolutely. We're looking for partners in that way as well.
Yeah. And I think I made my son write a thank you note to our local foundation that supports the books that we receive. I mean, because it's just, it's so, so wonderful. So if you are, said, a foundation or a donor that wants to, you know, support this work and expanding, and I will hold my breath for the fall for a new season of Beyond the Bookcase. Yes. And if you've not heard it, it's awesome. And the fact that my child knows what a golem is just, it's the best. And so thank you so much, Alex, for the conversation. Thank you for all the work that you do. Best of luck in all of it.
Thank you so much.
Liked this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.